Welcome to this Unorthodoxy podcast. I am sure you will agree that it's time we had a little talk about blasphemy. It's been a year since I started this podcast, which I can't believe, and this is the 30th episode. So I figured that it would be a nice idea to, in some sense, mirror the first episode of the Unorthodoxy podcast, which was on heresy. I want to play with the idea of blasphemy, because that's mostly what I do here on this podcast. I play with ideas. I want to play with an idea, so even though there's some serious stuff in what I'm saying, I'm hoping that we can see where the idea takes us, rather than simply seeing it as a way of me just trying to be right. So because I want to play with an idea, this means treating the idea of blasphemy a little more loosely than we would normally do, more as a poetic idea than as a literal thing with precise boundaries. I mentioned theopoetics on this podcast before, but just to revisit the idea, my purpose is to get beyond using language as something akin to a scientific tool. In any case, language doesn't really function like that. It's intended for more than that. It's evocative and provocative and not just informative. It's not just about information. The poetry in theopoetics doesn't have to be great poetry to be effective, but at the very least, it should help us to see things a little differently. That's more or less how I'm going to use the word blasphemy. Spike Milligan, I'm not sure if you know of him, but he's just this mad British writer, and he's got this very, very funny book called The Bible According to Spike Milligan, and it's a book that really makes me laugh, but it occasionally strikes a tone that I'm sure at least some people will think of as blasphemous. For instance, at one spot in the book, Moses and God are talking, and Moses stubs his toe and he says, "Jesus Christ," and God says, "Hey, that'll be a good name for my son." Is that just a joke, or is it really blasphemous when Spike Milligan says this? I'm hoping that you'll be able to suspend judgment for a while as we look into a theological possibility or two. Even though the subject is blasphemy, and even while my intention is to call the whole notion of blasphemy into question, my intention is definitely not to offend. I want to figure out if deconstructing this idea of blasphemy can help me to think of theology a little differently, and maybe in the process can help you to think of a few of your own ideas. I also think that talking about blasphemy at this time is appropriate, given that the current global political climate is not always so great, especially since Donald Trump is now the president of the most powerful country in the world. It's an alarming thought, and because of all this, I find that the line between blasphemy and prayer has become particularly thin. Every time Trump says another idiotic, hateful thing, someone in the world is going to be muttering Jesus or oh my God under their breath or out loud, and it'll be difficult to tell if they're just filling a blank space carved out by their own bewilderment with words or if they're hoping for some kind of second coming, even if they don't really believe in a second coming. As most people understand it, blasphemy seems so commonplace these days that it's easy to hear it without even blinking your eye. The phrase, for instance, of "Oh my God," may at one time have been offensive, but by now it's so normal, even among particularly devout theists. Some of my British friends are particularly fond of using the word God as an interjection, as in "God, yes," or "Oh God, how awful," without even thinking for a moment of what they're saying. I guess this is the psychological phenomenon of habituation at work. We get used to things, and so they stop affecting us. The potency of some words seems to wear out in some ways, but the question remains, and I think it's worth exploring, doesn't this sort of language go against the biblical commandment not to blaspheme? It would certainly seem to, but then again, maybe there is secretly and unconsciously a kind of signal of transcendence built into blasphemy, and that's one of the things that I want to play with here. So I have a very simple twofold aim here. First, I want to talk about a fresh way of maybe understanding the biblical commandment against blasphemy, which is in Exodus 20, verse 7, which has these words, "Don't use the name of the Lord your God in vain." And then, in the light of this interpretation of Exodus 20, I want to offer a few thoughts on rethinking blasphemy as a theological category. I will, as you will notice soon enough, be enlisting some Chestertonian thinking on the subject. This will, as you may have guessed, not be a complete theological exploration of blasphemy. No podcast could really ever explore any theme in total perfection. But I'm hoping it'll act as a kind of catalyst for conversation and thought. Let's dig in first by looking at Exodus 20 verse 7, which has these words, "Don't use the name of the Lord your God in vain." We read this now, or hear this now, in the modern world, and immediately think about words, because the line, "Don't use the name of the Lord your God in vain," contains the phrase, "name of the Lord," and that makes it sound like "name of the Lord" is what we should be thinking about. We assume that we should not say God's actual name needlessly. And of course, in a certain sense, this might be what Exodus 20 verse 7 is getting at. Remember that bit in John 14 verse 13, where Jesus tells his disciples that whatever they ask for, they should ask for in his name. Which has meant that many Christians today add the words, "and I pray this in Jesus' name," at the end of their prayers. It's also why some older prayers finish with, "in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost." Sometimes today, we feel like this is a bit like adding a tagline at the end of a television commercial, as if we're branding our prayers and reminding God that we've said the magic words, "abracadabra, amen." It's like saying, this prayer is brought to you in connection with Nike or Coca-Cola, or in this case, God. Magic words, right? But on some level, obviously, we know that this branding of prayers must be nonsense. And that's because it really is nonsense. In pre-modern cultures, names were not separate from the people they referred to. As Owen Barfield shows in his work, in pre-modern cultures, there would have been no separation between thoughts and words and actions, or any other part of ourselves. Words referred to our inner life and our external worlds as if the two things were connected. It's only with the rise of nominalism and modernity and enlightenment that we've started to split and divide everything up. Words become things that we attach randomly to things, it seems. This is what semiotic theorists call polysemy. It's this idea that words are arbitrary, that cats could have been toasters and cars could have been trees, not in real life, but just as labels, and the word God or Yahweh could have been something else. But this is a very recent modern idea, and it's not necessarily reflective of the kind of consciousness that the biblical writers had. So when the ancients heard about the name of the Lord, for example, they would have thought not about the word only, but who and what it was intricately part of. Using the name in vain was not just about a particular way of regarding the person, but was about a particular way of asking how our own very own being is bound up in the life, in this case, of God. Today, we easily forget that we are whole beings and not just bits and pieces. Think, for instance, about the commandment in Deuteronomy 6 verse 5, which reads, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." We might read this as heart, then soul, then strength, as if these are different components of ourselves. We have hearts, and then we have souls, and then we have this physicality attached to us, and that's, you know, we should focus on each of these different areas, and this is how we love, basically. But in a pre-modern consciousness, this would have been read as, "Love the Lord your God with your entire self." So using the name of the Lord your God in vain would have had a subtler meaning, something along the lines of, "Live with God with your whole being." This is not to say that we are not composite selves, but that we are first ourselves as whole people, and only then are we composites. The parts always need to be understood in terms of the whole. So here's what I'm getting at. The mistake in those ancient times was not primarily about using God's name incorrectly, like saying "God damn it" when you discover that you're gluten intolerant, or when, despite everything, your country managed to vote a narcissistic 8-year-old into power. Maybe these holy expletives are symptoms of blasphemy. but they are not blasphemy per se, at least in if we're looking at this sort of ancient way of understanding blasphemy. I'm also not saying, by the way, that this use of the name of divinity as a cuss word is entirely neutral, nor am I saying that it's good or bad. My point is not that how we speak is unimportant. It's that the bigger issue is always the whole trajectory of our lives. Remember the Didache? I spoke about it way, way back. And the Didache, this early Christian document with a strange name, goes on about community living. And it starts with this idea that there are two ways, the way of life and the way of death. The way of death is all about fragments, but the way of life is wholeness. This idea is really beautifully and powerfully communicated by Abraham Joshua Heschel in his book, God in Search of Man. Heschel writes that when we read the law, we need to understand that the idea is not to do what God wills, but to do what he is. Somehow God is evident in our agency, in our actual enactments, as if life is a drama that we participate in. In particular, Heschel focuses on the holiness code in Leviticus 19's injunction to love others. And then he writes this: "We live by the conviction that acts of goodness reflect the hidden light of God's holiness. His light is above our minds, but not beyond our will. It is within our power to mirror this unending love in deeds of kindness, like brooks that hold the sky." It's so beautiful, right? Heschel, in essence, says that even though we can't ever properly understand God, something which I'll get to shortly, we can still love others by doing what we can. Even when we feel totally broken, we can still live God out. Even in our atheism, God is the love between people. Even if we might not believe for a second that God exists, somehow God persists. But as you'll see shortly, this even has an effect on how we conceive of theistic belief. It's not just about some kind of radical theology, but is something that incorporates all kinds of theology. With this in mind, let's turn back to the common understanding of blasphemy. If blasphemy in the early pre-modern biblical context and consciousness is about living into a more damaged or more destructive process of living, it's about living life in hatred and fragmentation, how can we maybe think about blasphemy and blasphemous language in this post-postmodern or whatever else you may call it age? I want to look at two ways to understand the language of blasphemy. The first is that blasphemy is belief dependent, and then the second is that blasphemy is a kind of negative theology. Both of these ideas are rooted in the work of G.K. Chesterton. So the first idea is that blasphemy is belief dependent, and this is put so well by Chesterton. He writes, "Blasphemy is an artistic effect because blasphemy depends upon philosophical conviction. Blasphemy depends upon belief and is fading with it. If anyone doubts this, let him sit down seriously and try to think blasphemous thoughts about Thor. I think his family will find him at the end of the day in a state of some exhaustion." So blasphemy, at least in its modern conception as a linguistic concern, it's about how we speak apparently, is itself, as Chesterton seems to suggest here, pointing to a kind of faith. I find this especially true when I look at the work of the new atheists. For them, God is entirely fictional. Richard Dawkins, for instance, famously says that God is the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. Now, what I find really interesting is that the new atheists get really, really, really angry and verbally quite aggressive about this fictional so-called character. It's a bit like getting mad at Frodo when he acts like a bastard towards Samwise Gamgee. It feels like they protest a little too much. And what all that protesting feels like is not quite blasphemy, but a kind of fidelity. It's almost loving. They're angry at a vengeful, distant, bigoted God. And I kind of applaud their anger, but what I want to ask is, what is the love that drives that anger? Where did that come from? For me, the blasphemy of the new atheists is this kind of beautiful act of fidelity. It's more like unresolved and poorly understood faith than it is a cause to believe that there is an absence of faith. It's like the anger of a 2-year-old when their mom just doesn't give them what they want. It's a clash with reality and a rage that wishes it could understand that reality better. Remember that cliche, "I also don't believe in the God that you don't believe in"? It gets used a lot around the new atheist, and I find it a little bit irritating, and it's potentially a little condescending even. Well, I think maybe there's some truth in that, but I also think it doesn't go far enough, which is why we need to turn to the second idea around blasphemy. So we've looked at the first Chestertonian idea, which is this idea that blasphemy is belief dependent. And the second idea is probably a bit strange, and I'm going to offer it in a form of a question. What if blasphemy is a kind of negative theology? To get to the background of this question, I'm going to turn to another Chestertonian idea. Chesterton has this wonderful essay on the book of Job, which everyone should read. It's amazing. I spent a whole chapter in my book on Chesterton just unpacking the brilliant hermeneutic gestures accessible in that chapter, because it's so deep and just so true. Job, as you know, I hope, is this story about a guy who goes through hell. Not in the Dante-esque sense, but in sort of some just like terrible things happen to him. And he argues with friends about the nature of reality and his terrible situation until eventually God shows up, which I guess we should all have been expecting. And when God shows up, God is so much on the same page as Job that God himself seems utterly perplexed. Job doesn't know what's going on, but somehow neither does God. And Chesterton writes that when God shows up and starts speaking, he comes across as a blasphemer. Chesterton says that God even seems like an atheist. God's fidelity to Job looks an awful lot like infidelity to himself. This is an odd idea, obviously, but let's work with it. Elsewhere, Chesterton talks about the death of Christ and specifically the cry of dereliction, which is when Jesus calls out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The cry of the suffering Jesus comes across as also being a bit blasphemous, because how can a God who is everywhere not be present to his own incarnation? Chesterton says that on the cross, like the God of the book of Job, Jesus seems like an atheist. I'm aware of the various interpretations of this Chestertonian idea, especially those by Peter Rollins and Slavoj Žižek, and I've already written a scholarly article for the Expository Times on the subject, but I'm not going to go into those. I might revisit this idea in a later podcast. My intention here is to look at the fact that Chesterton couples atheism with blasphemy, which I've already done in a way, and this builds on the idea that blasphemy reflects belief. And it also brings me to this idea that blasphemy is a kind of negative theology. Negative theology has been a part of the Christian tradition for as long as the Christian tradition has been the Christian tradition. You'll find it in the work of Pseudo-Dionysius, Meister Eckhart, Thomas Aquinas, and many others. And it comes with this basic idea, which is that we can never really say what God is, only what he is not. It's easier to talk about the divine with an awareness that language cannot ever be accurate. Negative theology is the reminder that in some sense, even as Chesterton says, Christianity is nonsense. Talking about God is like feeling the taste of the word blue, which is why we need metaphors and analogies. By the way, I wonder if it's possible to write a book of theology entirely out of non sequiturs. What would that look like? I challenge you to be the one who does this. Anyway, negative theology begins with this deep awareness that God is not a being like we are, but is beyond being. Not a thing, but beyond things. God is the ground of being. But even so, the phrases beyond being and beyond things must be purely negative in meaning. Eric Pearl has got this amazing book called Theophany, and he says there that negative theology doesn't consist merely in negative language, for even such language still represents conceptual definition and intellectual apprehension. To say that God is not this is inescapably to think it as something else. We must negate even such negative definitions, including the name God itself. Okay, so that's a bit of a mouthful, but I think it's brilliantly put. As I said, the cliche goes that when we hear of someone talking blasphemy about God, we can respond, well, I don't believe in that God either. This principle makes good sense because it points out that atheism functions as a kind of negative theology, but what I think we need to do is go further. What if theology itself is always negative theology? I think the logical result of our thinking is this, that I don't even believe in the God that I believe in. I can talk about God, but the God that I'm talking about doesn't exist in the way that my words want her to. Atheism may be a kind of belief. That's fine, that's brilliant, but belief can function as a kind of atheism even for the most faithful believers. I mean, this is right there with Simone Weil's idea that we all need to be atheists. She says, God exists, God doesn't exist. Where's the contradiction? I love it. She writes this, God exists, God doesn't exist. What's the problem with this? She says, there's no uncertainty whatsoever. I am absolutely certain that there is a God, in the sense that I'm absolutely certain that my love is not illusory. I am absolutely certain that there is not a God, in the sense that I'm absolutely certain that there is nothing real which bears a resemblance to what I am able to conceive when I pronounce the name God. We could say that God is a nothingness that does not have any kind of form. Insofar as God is nothingness, knowledge of God is given to humanity only through contact with God. So there you go. I don't believe in the God that I believe in, even when I believe in God. Maybe mysteries aren't necessarily meant to be understood. They're meant to be lived. And maybe then blasphemy, at least in its linguistic sense, might raise a few questions. How have I turned even my positive conceptions of God into an idol? How can negations of God act as affirmations of God? How can negations be growth points and provocations that challenge and develop faith? One of the reasons that we keep on talking about God is that it's actually impossible to talk about God. It's a little like trying to catch the ocean in a paper cup when the ocean is not even tangible. We just don't have the right tools. In any case, this reminds me of Chesterton's quip that the madman is someone who tries to fit the heavens into his head, and the result is that his head explodes. A mystic, on the other hand, tries to fit his head into the heavens. And by experiencing the mystery, we are closer to realizing that language is this house that we live in, but it is also the house that we are. And we're occasionally meant to leave this house so that we can explore other aspects of our being in the world. And I think that Chesterton's and Simone Weil's point is that we need to live it out in some weird sort of way. And as I said, my aim here is not really to conclude this subject, but to provoke thought. So I'm going to leave you with just one last question. How, instead of talking about love, can we do what God is? Thank you so much again for listening to this Unorthodoxy podcast. My name is Duncan Rayburn, and you are very welcome to support the Unorthodoxy podcast at Patreon. You can also mail me at unorthodoxy@zoho.com. Cheers for now.